Chapter 7, The Seventh Principle, Problem Solving, Not Punishment, Teaches Responsibility. Mom, you have to find out what to do instead of sending me to my room when I do something wrong, because it doesn't work, you know. All it does is make me mad. This 5-year-old boy sent his mother to her parenting class with this assignment. Remember when you were a child and were sent to your room or grounded? Did you use that time to think about your actions and contemplate a better way? I doubt it. When I sent Molly to her room and she climbed out her window, slid down to the porch, and ran off, I learned that she would not tolerate what she considered unfair treatment. I had a choice. I could come down harder and harder with the strong possibility of raising an insurgent, or I could find out what to do instead. I learned that when I treated her with respect and logic, she responded in kind. Punitive reactions to misbehavior do nothing to teach responsibility, unless out of fear. As I learned and have witnessed with so many families, they actually promote future misbehavior. Children hate to be punished, and the parents I know hate to punish. They just don't know what else to do. Punishment has been with us for so long, it's hard to trust that fairness and logic will teach anything, a foreign concept when it comes to disciplining children. With punishment, children either behave out of fear or behave badly out of defense. When children who have been punished do behave, they do so because their temperaments are adaptable and their motivation is to please, not because of the punishment. Adaptable children are the easiest to mold to our wishes. They are also the easiest to motivate with fairness and logic. However, they respond obediently to punishment and usually do not fight back when treated disrespectfully. So we believe that punishment works. But children who take punishment with no argument are likely to repress feelings of unfairness and resentment. If trouble is not showing up in misbehavior, look for physical signs of stress or tension. For instance, frequent stomach aches or headaches, hair pulling, stuttering, bedwetting, withholding bowel movements. Control versus authority. How can I maintain control of my child if I don't punish? This question is based in the fear of losing control. The pressure is tremendous. This parent may be looking for a replacement for punishment, but wants the same result. Some form of coercion is all that can be imagined. This parent cannot trust a balanced relationship where mutual respect promotes cooperation, where discipline affects the internal motivation of children so external methods of control become obsolete, where mistakes are opportunities for learning, and where non-directive parenting allows for children to be problem solvers. Being in control of yourself, having personal power and confidence is what grants authority. True authority means the ability to gain the respect of and to influence or guide another. It has nothing to do with controlling another and all to do with controlling yourself. Positive influence does not happen when you're holding power over your child. The problem with punishment. When children are afraid of getting in trouble, they may do as they are told to avoid the trouble. A few problems with that. In order for a fear tactic to work, what the child fears must be formidable. Parents have to be ready to follow through with the fear tactic and maintain consistency with it. Many children resist fear tactics. Those who don't may behave to avoid what they fear, but will not learn the intrinsic value of right and wrong. They just learn not to get caught. The relationship with the child is risked when the child fears the parent. A relationship based on control through punishment is fuel for rebellion. Think of the last time you felt humiliated or put down for not doing what someone wanted you to do. Did that humiliation encourage your cooperation or stimulate your anger and resentment? If you did what they wanted, why did you? Did you feel coerced, trapped, misunderstood, unfairly accused? Chances are this is how your child feels when she's punished. Punishment can cause children to be vengeful, sneaky, rebellious, and retaliatory, often taking out their feelings of humiliation and shame on siblings, peers, or pets. The power of choice and consequences. Children need to experience the consequences of their behavior. But when we fix their problems, sometimes by punishing, they don't learn the natural consequences of their own mistakes. We are too attached to being right to trust our children to solve their own problems. We nag endlessly. We get into power struggles to make them see it our way. We force coats on and make special meals so they don't learn the consequence of being cold or hungry. We don't want to deal with meltdowns, so we give in, and they don't learn delayed gratification. We can't stand them to be sad or unhappy, certainly not angry, so they don't learn how to handle their emotions. And when they misbehave, all we do is dole out a consequence, the politically correct word for punishment. Withholding computer or television privileges, grounding, being put in timeout, these are not consequences. They're punishments. But we feel better when we call them consequences. The simplest means of giving consequences is by posing a choice and handing over responsibility for that choice. Do you want to lower your voices or play outside? Do you want to put your coat on or take it with you? Would you rather hand me that truck or shall I take it? Do you want to turn off the TV or shall I? You can either do your assignment or get a bad grade. It's up to you. When children have the opportunity to make choices, they feel strong. If they refuse to make the choice, you can offer to make it for them. The power of the choice, when offered genuinely, is one a trusting child will rarely turn down. A 3-year-old whined about not being able to get her shoes on. Instead of criticizing her with "stop whining," her father said, "Do you want to put them on yourself or do you want me to do it?" She sat back sniffling, held her feet out to her father, and stopped whining. The same child picked out the dress she wanted to wear the night before. As is appropriate for her age, she often changed her mind. When she wanted her good dress, her mother said, "Not a church dress, but you can choose this one or that one." Sometimes there was frustration and whining, but she always made the choice. Her older brothers were fighting with each other because one had lost the coins that had come with their pirate ship. After arguing about who did what, their mother said, "I'll give you a choice. Either forget about them and be thrilled when they show up, or you both go and look for them now. Which do you choose?" "If you can't, I'll make the choice." They chose to look for the coins, stopped fighting, and found them a few minutes later. There's always a choice. When Molly was 5, she needed glasses. She had to wear a patch on her eye, have drops in her eyes, and listen to her eye doctor call her honey. One day, she refused to go to her appointment. I somehow got her in the car, but when we arrived, she didn't want to get out. She said, "I haven't decided yet whether I'm going in or not." As I reached in for her hand, I said, "You don't have a choice about whether or not you go in, but you do have a choice about how you feel about it." This intrigued her. She took my hand. I continued with, "You can be really angry about this, not like your doctor, and hate your glasses. Or you can tell yourself that your eyes are part of your body, and you're taking care of your body with glasses that help your eyes. Your eyes are yours for the rest of your life, and you'll need them to be in the best shape they can be." We walked on quietly. I ventured, "So have you decided which you'll choose?" She said very thoughtfully, "Not yet." When we reached the door, she said, "I guess I'll be okay about it." She hopped up in the doctor's chair like a trooper. She never complained again about her glasses and took excellent care of them for years. She'd been handed a choice that helped her feel important and understood. She took it instead of being the victim of circumstances. What to do instead? The shift to problem solving. Connection is the most effective way to address the fear and stress that provokes inappropriate behavior. Chapter 5 gave you connective communication tools to address the roots of the behavior. Often it's enough to give vent to the feelings for the behavior to disappear, but when it isn't enough, when we need to guide children to choose different behavior, the final stage of connective communication is problem solving. This is where we shift from statements to questions. This is what holds children accountable and teaches responsible thinking and decision-making. Punishment is easy and makes kids mad. Problem solving is hard, but has logic and fairness embedded in the process. Problem solving needs to be learned and takes time, but far less time than the arguing and power struggles that result from threats and punishment. Camilla was 4. She had quite a temper and had taken to throwing things. Her mother, Melanie, shared a simple story with me. Camilla was angry about being told she had to put her toys away. She picked up a plastic strawberry and threw it under the table. Angrily, Melanie told her to pick it up. Camilla did, only to throw it again at Melanie. Melanie picked up the strawberry and put it in her pocket. Camilla fell to the floor in a fit of rage, screaming that she hated her mother. Melanie, rougher than she liked, took her to her room. The screaming continued for quite some time. Camilla learned nothing from this incident. A strong-willed child, any child for that matter, would respond better to logic and a challenge. After the second throw, Melanie might pick up the strawberry and say, "You are very angry with me about putting your toys away. You have a choice to make. You can either put this strawberry in the bin where it belongs, or I will put it in my pocket. Which do you choose?" A tantrum may occur anyway if Camilla's stress level is too high to manage. After the tantrum has subsided is a good time for problem solving. "You were mad at me, and you threw that strawberry because you were mad. What do you think is the best thing to do with the strawberry now that you got your mad out?" Most likely, Camilla will now put the strawberry where it belongs. Then Melanie could offer, "Would you like me to help you put the rest of your toys away, or can you do it yourself?" Engaging the child in the problem. Problem solving involves asking some form of the following questions. How can you make that happen? How can we make this work for both of us? And what would you like to do about it? While our traditional definition of discipline leads most parents to think in terms of control, punishment, and obedience, problem solving encourages us to think in terms of guiding, thinking, and negotiating. Instead of judge and director telling the child what to think, do, and say, the parent becomes facilitator and guide of the child's thought process by asking questions and gently leading him to accountability and decision-making. But the outcome may not be what the parent expected. Telling children what to do and how to do it teaches very little. "You shouldn't feel that way. He's your best friend. You need to say you're sorry. You've hurt his feelings, and he's telling you he doesn't like it." All well-intentioned, but the child either parrots or ignores the direction, taking no responsibility for his problem. And the parent's way of handling the problem is not necessarily the best way for the child to handle it. Children are usually way more creative than we are and have a language of their own. Instead, try problem solving. Notice how it's interlaced with connective communication. Parent: "You look pretty upset right now. Something must have happened." Child: "Sam sat with our enemies at lunch today and wouldn't let me sit with them." His answer will be nothing if he thinks you will tell him what to do. Parent: "Oh, wow. That must have felt crummy coming from your best friend." Child: "He acted so stuck up. What's with him anyway?" Have any idea what might have led to it? No, he's a jerk. Maybe you need a little time away from each other. A question, not a direction. "I don't know, maybe. I did get really mad at him in math class today." "Oh, really? What was that about?" Not critical, genuine curiosity. He butted in with the answer. He thinks he's so darn smart and has to let everybody know. Sounds like you took offense and let him know. "Yeah, so now he's snubbing me." "What do you think you'd like to do about it?" "I don't know. I don't feel like talking to him." "What do you think might happen if you don't talk to him?" "Well, he'll probably think I hate him and snub me even more." "Do you hate him?" "No, I just get mad when he thinks he's so smart. I'm smarter than him, but I don't show it off." "Do you think you can let it go?" "I guess. It's not really that big a deal. It's just that we both agreed we didn't like those kids he sat with today." So you feel kind of betrayed." "Yeah." "So what do you feel like doing about that?" "I want to tell him that he's a suck-up." How do you think he'd respond to that?" "Well, he'd call me some stupid name, probably." "How did his sucking up make you feel?" "Mad and left out." "What if you told him that?" "I guess. He'd probably say he was sorry. I guess he was really mad at me for saying what I did." I know you'll know the right thing to do when the time is right. This parent skillfully guided her son through his own thoughts to help him come to his own conclusion. Her son was able to think it through and name his feelings because this kind of process had been happening for a while. He trusted his mother. She wasn't attached to the outcome. She trusted he could work it out in his own way. This may sound like an episode of the Brady Bunch, and many children find it hard to engage for so long, but when we get in the habit of guiding conversation like this, children are forthcoming because they trust our neutrality and they want to work it out. When we tell them what we want them to do, what we would do if we were in their shoes. They tune out and lose their ability to problem solve. A typical answer to, what do you think you should do, becomes a very lifeless, I don't know. This type of conversation takes a while to master. Your child needs to trust that you do not have ulterior motives that may suddenly appear. The key is remaining neutral and knowing it is not your problem to fix. You don't have to have the answer. In fact, you shouldn't have the answer. It's so much easier than you think. Accountability and logic. When your child has made a bad choice, he needs to be held accountable. Contrary to popular opinion, punishment does not teach accountability. Problem solving does. The child is again engaged in the solution and will follow through when it seems fair and logical. Jeff, age 8, is a morning dawdler. School was several miles away, and driving him herself was not an option Michelle could always afford. One morning, Jeff missed the bus. Assuming his mother would take him, he started playing basketball in the driveway. Watching him through the window gave Michelle a minute to collect her thoughts. She told him to stop playing basketball and come inside. Then she said, "I have to be at a meeting at 9:30, almost an hour away. Missing the bus has put me in a terrible crunch, and I need your help. I need you to feed Lucy and take out the recyclables." Jeff tried, "Okay, but how about if I feed Lucy and you take out the recyclables? It'll save time." Michelle countered, "No, because I have to make my breakfast and eat." It made logical sense, so Jeff complied. After those things had been done, Michelle said, "Now I need you to get the rug samples from the bedroom and bring them to the car, along with the folder on the counter and the movies in the living room that need to go back." Jeff did what he was asked and started playing basketball again. Michelle called to him, "Jeff, I need you to stop playing and come back inside." He did. "Get a pencil and paper and write a list for me." Michelle dictated her grocery list as she gathered her things together and then asked Jeff to carry her uneaten breakfast to the car. Once in the car, she asked calmly, "Jeff, do you see how the choices we make affect other people?" Notice she used "we," thereby eliminating blame. "Yeah. What could you do differently so this doesn't happen again?" "I could use my alarm clock to get up earlier and then have more time for resting in the morning." Michelle nodded and asked, "And what will motivate you to get to the bus on time?" "Well, if I miss the bus, I don't get to talk with other kids, and on the days I have gym and art, I don't have time before class. The bus gets me there earlier." Jeff was cooperative with his mother because he knew he was responsible for causing a problem for her, and he didn't feel accused, so he didn't need to react defensively. It seemed logical and fair to him. There are still mornings when his slowness causes a problem, but instead of taking away computer time, something that always resulted in battles, Michelle now uses logic. Logical consequences. Appealing to the child's natural sense of logic works. Many children have a heightened sense of justice and react badly to punishments because they don't seem fair. For instance, many children have to be held down in timeout chairs or they won't stay. Whatever the purpose of the timeout is certainly defeated. Taking the time to find out what your child responds to saves so much time in the long run. If a child breaks or harms something, she must buy a new one using her allowance, earning the money, or being involved in the repair. If she leaves her bike out in the rain, she must dry it and work the rust off with products she must buy, or she doesn't get to ride her bike for a while. If she drops food or makes a mess, she's handed a broom and dustpan or cleaning products to clean it up. If her father's tools are left out after she's used them, she must stop whatever she's doing to put them away. Logic works. It rarely gets an argument. There are plenty of problems that don't have logical answers. If the behavior is the result of heightened anger, it's better to hold the child accountable after the emotion has cooled. For instance, calling someone a bad name may require the child to go back and say what he really meant. If a toy is grabbed away and thrown, it must be retrieved and handed back. But if feelings are high, resistance is likely. Cooperation comes more easily after the emotion has calmed. The best consequence is a choice. Either you do what I ask or experience the consequence, which is set ahead of time with the child. When Joe asked his parents for an iPod, their biggest concern was that he would be plugged in around the house and in the car so conversation would stop. His parents had some stipulations. "If we're going to buy this iPod, we would like you to agree that when you're hanging around the kitchen or in the car with us, you'll not use it." Joe asked. Well, what if I'm just going to the kitchen to get something and leaving again? They agreed that would be all right. Other agreements were made about times of the day it could not be used. Then Joe's dad said, What do you think the consequence should be if any of these agreements are broken?
They won't be dead, don't worry, Joe said offhandedly. But just in case, I think you need to know what will happen, his dad said.
I don't know. Take it away, I guess, Joe offered.
Well, that makes logical sense, his dad said. How about taking it away for a day to see if that's motivation enough to remind you? They agreed.
A consequence set ahead of time can offset arguments or power struggles, especially when it's in writing. Then the agreement needs only to be mentioned or pointed to. It's clear. The iPod will be handed over, regretfully, but understandably, if, in fact, Jeff is required to do so. It's logical. Consequences need to be carried out to be effective. Many parents drop the ball at this point because they don't want to upset their child or deal with an argument.
All right, just this once. Children learn the consequence is not real and pay no attention. Power struggles break out and children are blamed for being irresponsible. Effective limit setting begins with setting limits on ourselves. Remember the definition of discipline, the ability to behave in a controlled and calm way, even in a difficult or stressful situation. That is the parent's responsibility. It is not the responsibility of the child to be the grown-up first. Negotiating. Children are masters at arguing and negotiating. This is a great skill to promote. Children who are allowed to argue their case at home and negotiate decisions think more creatively and often do better in school. However, negotiating can become endless and exhausting if you don't know where to end it. Your child will not stop first. So, negotiate and argue, yes, but when you have come to your final decision, be clear that it's over. Your child may be mad about the decision. That's his right. Your right is to be done. When you engage in endless arguing, you lose authority. You must be the first to disengage. Mean what you say and say what you mean. Just make sure that what you say is fair and respectful.
How to negotiate effectively. Acknowledge that what your child is arguing about is important to her. Ask to hear her side of the story or her point of view and take it seriously. State what's important to you, your concerns, and your side of the story. Ask, How can we make this work for both of us? Or, how can you make that happen? Be open-minded and willing to compromise, but be clear when you have reached your final answer. When your child builds a good case with information that supports his claim and you listen and allow him a win, he builds confidence in himself. A good argument means creative thinking and problem-solving, excellent skills for later in life that need to be nurtured. When somebody else always knows better and doesn't take the time to listen, he feels defeated. Allow your child a win when the argument is a good one, rather than reacting with an automatic answer. But if you know you will not change your position, let your child know that and stop engaging. Contracts. When contracts are needed, negotiating takes another step. Usually, contracts are written when parents want to change some behavior, like television viewing or computer time, but they can't be used for a variety of situations. Christie's boys, Trevor, 9, and William, 6, loved writing contracts. One contract involved the family choosing specific words to stop another when his anger was elevating. Trevor chose fart for the word anyone could use with him. William's was fire, and the word the boys chose to say when their mom's anger was intensifying was pudding. One afternoon, Christie heard Trevor's angry voice upstairs yelling, Get out of my stuff or I'm going to kill you! Christie went upstairs to see what was going on. William was back far away from Trevor and was cowering. Christie said, William, what's the word? Remembering, William stood tall and said, Fart, fart, fart! Trevor couldn't help a quick smile. It was just enough to back down a bit. Christie said, William, what do you want to say to Trevor? William came closer and said, Trevor, it makes me scared when you yell at me like that. The following are some of the contracts that Trevor wrote after talking them through with his mother and brother. The throwing contract. We the Denbys will not throw things, except for frisbees, balls, and dog toys. The consequences for the person that throws will be that they will have to pick up the mess and be nice to the person you threw at, and if something broke, they would pay for repairs.
the brother's contract. We, the brothers, promise to be kind. Trevor would like William not to touch these certain things. My gun and suction darts. No going in my room without permission. My journal. My new movies. If William asks, Trevor may agree to share these items. William would like Trevor to share on play dates, no busting in William's room to take film props, not change the TV channel without asking, and not say he hates William. The basement or kid town rules. No one goes in without permission from a kid. No food without permission from an adult. No kids allowed on the gym equipment unless you are over 5 years old. No stealing, no punching, or kicking. No adults without kids' permission unless emergency. Thank you. You have two warnings. If all the warnings are broken, you will go to Kid Town Jail. The TV contract. We, the Denby kids, will try to remember not to argue about the shows we watch. If we can't agree on a program, Trevor will go to the other room to watch his program. We agree to watch only 1 hour of TV a day unless Mom and Dad agree to a special movie. The kids do not have to all watch the same hour, but if you choose to, you don't get another hour. No one will walk into the room and change the channel someone else is watching without first asking. William can watch anything on PBS, Nick Jr., or another pre-approved program. Trevor can watch Nick, Boomerang, Animal Planet, or Discovery Channels. For sure, there will be no Rugrats, SpongeBob, Fairly Odd Parents, or Cartoon Network. Here's one a bit more formal written by the parent for her 7-year-old son. Computer contract. 1. No computer in the mornings before school or breakfast. 2. Computer hours are from 5 to 6 and 7:30 to 8:30 p.m. Simon agrees to do homework after school before getting on the computer. 3. Simon agrees to get off the computer when it's mealtime. 4. The computer goes off at 8:30 p.m. every night. Mom will give one 30-minute warning and one 15-minute warning. 5. If Simon fails to address his personal needs while on the computer, the consequence will be loss of the computer for 1 day. 6. If Simon does not follow these rules, the consequence will be loss of the computer for 2 days. We all agree to this contract and to follow the rules stated above. Signatures of Dad, Mom, and Simon. Contracts allow children to have a say, negotiate rules and consequences, and hear other points of view. They foster respect for the rights and needs of others, but most importantly, they empower the contract writers. They can be simple and short, but if they are thought out and co-written, not dictated by the parent, they are very effective. Empowering children with non-directed play. All day long, children are told what to do and how to do it. They're given little opportunity to take responsibility for themselves. If we could look down from above, we would see little pawns being moved around by giants on life's game board. We giants expect that in the moving, we're teaching our pawns the right moves so they'll do the same when they're giants. But our children are different players at a different time and need to learn to play by their own rules. Remember sandlot baseball, when neighborhood kids would get together any time they could at the empty lot, out in the street, or at the playground to choose teams and play ball? No coaches, no parents, no supervision. The basic rules of the game provided a structure within which kids decided the rules of playing together and the consequences of not following those rules. Now adults set the rules, the teams, the schedules, the pressure, and the consequences. And it doesn't stop with baseball. How much time do your children spend in non-directed, unsupervised play? Play fosters imagination, creativity, brain circuitry, and even responsibility. When children are continually supervised and directed, they lose the ability to be spontaneous, to create, and to develop and respect the rules of play and of life. Our attempts to protect our children from harm and to supervise and schedule their lives so we have more control are inadvertently setting them up to fail. By dictating rules to our children, fixing their problems, and hovering over everything they do, we take away their opportunities to learn by trial and error. Of course, intervention is often necessary, but problem-solving involves them doing the thinking and taking responsibility. As we restrain our compulsion to tell them what to do, we risk them making mistakes, falling, and maybe even failing. But if we understand that falling is part of the game, We will also see them gaining the strength to get back up again with a better understanding of how the game is played. A father in one of my workshops wrote at the end, "I don't need to stop her from falling. I only need to warn her about the fall and be there once she has fallen." The steps of problem solving. 1. Take all situations seriously. 2. Hear your child's side of the story. 3. Listen, validate feelings, and acknowledge the importance of the situation. For instance, "That sounds really important to you." 4. Facilitate your child's thinking. "How do you think you could get her to do what you want? How much time do you think is reasonable for you to spend playing video games? How do you think she feels when you say or do something like that? Why do you think he doesn't want to give that to you?" 5. State your concerns. Own them. "Here's what I'm concerned about. I know you don't care about this, but I do. Here's what I think. Can we come to an agreement?" 6. Ask your child what he needs. Sometimes just venting is enough. "How do you want this to turn out? What do you think you can do about it? What do you need from me?" 7. Ask if your child would like your opinion, help, or advice. 8. Ask for what you need. No blame. "I need to feel assured that you'll be safe. I need about an hour of help from you." Allow the child to think it through, guiding with questions rather than directing. 10. Make lists of ideas and cross off any that cannot be agreed on. 11. Make an agreement. How can we make this work for both of us? Each of these steps may take a while and require discussion. Your child may not be happy about the outcome. That's okay. The important step is that you come to an agreement. If you can't, table the discussion and come back to it later. Main ideas from Chapter 7. Parents who use punishment for control are in fear of losing control. Punishment causes children to feel powerless and often leads to sneaky, vengeful, or retaliatory behavior. Good discipline requires mutually established rules. Fear lies beneath anger. Punishments increase fear, provoking more anger. Consequences should be natural or logical, understood and agreed on ahead of time. A consequence should be set up as a choice. Either this or that, you choose. Problem solving is the final stage of connective communication and shifts from statements to questions. With problem solving, the parent becomes guide and facilitator of the child's thought process by asking leading questions. Negotiating is an important skill, but not to be engaged in endlessly. Allowing a child some wins builds confidence. Contracts must be co-written so children have a say, negotiate rules and consequences, and honor other points of view. Constant adult supervision robs children of decision-making skills. Practice. Catch yourself telling your child what to do or say. Stop, step back, and remember to let your child think for herself. Ask questions to help her make decisions. Remember, you are facilitating or guiding her thought process. Watch children's unsupervised play. See what you can learn about their natural ability to problem solve. Practice problem solving again and again and again.